On this week's 51%, the film shines a light on a suffragist.
She was very dramatic, on a white horse like a Joan of Arc, leading the women up the Pennsylvania Avenue.
And we hear different views about coming to the States, from a refugee girl, now a teen poet, and an immigrant girl, now an adult author. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%.
March, be courageous, fighting for our rights. We may just start greatness for the ages. Freedom, it is contagious. March, march, be courageous, fighting for our rights. We may just start greatness for the ages. Remember the ladies.
Not to be above, but equal to all men. We only ask to be part of this union. Comme dirait le français, c'est démocratie. I'm a citizen.
We begin the show with a look at a suffragist whose name does not readily come to mind for many, yet she was one of the most regarded suffragists of the early 20th century and is the only woman known to have died while pursuing the cause. A new documentary called Forward into Light looks at Inez Milholland, who is buried in the Adirondacks region of New York. Writer and producer Martha Wheelock visited Lewis in Essex County recently and talked about her film with 51%'s Pat Bradley.
Well, she's one of those unsung heroes that we should know. The most famous suffrage icon you never heard of, I always say. She's best known for the image that she presented in 1913 on a white horse leading the biggest suffrage march in Washington, D.C., where 8,000 women demanded their right to vote.
1913. Washington, D.C., the day before President Woodrow Wilson's inauguration. A massive spectacle of 8,000 women displaying their demand for the right to vote. The peaceful, dignified, colorful march is suddenly interrupted.
Men spat upon the women, slapped them in the face, tripped them, pelted them with cigar stubs, pulled them off floats, tore off their skirts, and cursed them. New York Times.
Now there appears a gallant figure out of the pressing throngs, a girl in white upon a white horse, dressed in flowing crusader's cloak, Inez Milholland. She courageously parts the way through the hordes of men and drives an opening for the marchers to continue. Hazel McKay.
The dignity of the marching women and the unruly behavior of the spectators creates press attention, public interest in the cause.
A quarter of a million spectators and another quarter of a million men came to see this march. And she was very dramatic, on a white horse like a Joan of Arc, leading the women up the Pennsylvania Avenue. Before that, she was a lawyer. She'd gotten her law degree at NYU after three colleges rejected her because she was a woman. She was a graduate of Vassar, where she was an outstanding student, athlete, and dramatist. And she made a lot of headway in her issues because she was beautiful. She was passionate and she was intellectual.
Do you see any sort of dichotomy in the fact that she was considered the beautiful suffragist as she fought for equal rights, mm-hmm. and having that caveat of beautiful?
That's
to be
a great,
able to get her point across.
That's a great question. She said, I'm going to use this for the greater good. But she actually milked it a lot, and then they would hear the message. She felt bad about that. Absolutely. She wrote about it, how she uncomfortable she felt. But she knew she was working for something bigger than herself.
She was influenced, as I understand it, by her father. So it wasn't necessarily all men that were against what she was doing.
No, right. Her father taught her political issues. He's from Lewis, New York. He was a philanthropist as well as one of the founders with Inez of the NAACP. He was more or less a socialist. He built a house in Lewis called Meadowmount, which had 34 bedrooms in it, where he wanted to bring poor kids from Brooklyn to have a feeling of country. He was always cutting edge, very religious man, but always very cutting edge in terms of his political and progressive views. And he gave that to his two daughters and his son. I think Inez had it in her blood from the very beginning and then fostered it by a good education. She also was in England, worked with the English suffragists.
Did you know about her a long time ago, or did you discover her shortly before you made the documentary?
I never knew that there was a person, there was a woman who died for my right to vote. And she dies in 1916, 100 years ago, because she went through the Western states urging the women who could vote, there were 11 states in the West where the women could vote. She went through those nine states giving 50 speeches in 24 days, and she became very ill. And she collapses in Los Angeles on October 24th, 1916.
Elegant even in her illness, Inez speaks ardently with fiery logic.
President Wilson, how long must women wait for liberty?
In the middle of this intense sentence, this remarkable woman crumpled up like a wilted white rose and lay stark upon the platform. Los Angeles Times.
Inez Milholland dies 3 weeks later in Los Angeles at the tender age of 30.
3 years later, women won their right to vote.
For 51%, I'm Pat Bradley.
Meanwhile, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo recently announced the kickoff of the New York State Women's Suffrage 100th Anniversary Commemoration Commission. The 14-member commission will work to promote the anniversary of women's suffrage between 2017, marking 100 years from when women won the right to vote in New York State, and 2020, a century after the 19th Amendment was ratified. The New York State Women's Suffrage 100th Anniversary Commemoration Commission was signed into law by Governor Cuomo in November. During its inaugural meeting, members of the commission outlined plans for commemoration events to take place over the next 3 years that highlight historic achievements for women. That meeting took place in Seneca Falls, the birthplace of the women's rights movement. Canada's National Police Force recently permitted its women officers to wear the hijab. Public Safety Minister Ralph Goodale's spokesman says the Commissioner of the Royal Canadian Mounted Police recently approved the addition to the uniform to allow Muslim women to wear the hijab. Scott Bardsley says it is intended to better reflect the diversity of Canada and to encourage more Muslim women to consider a career with the force. The Mounties faced a public backlash more than 25 years ago when a Sikh man took the government to court and won the right to wear his traditional turban instead of the usual Mountie headgear. And the Arizona Coyotes have hired Dawn Braid as skating coach and say she is believed to be the first full-time female coach in NHL history. Braid has a long association with the NHL. She worked part-time for the Coyotes last year and has served as a skating consultant with the Toronto Maple Leafs, Anaheim Ducks, Buffalo Sabres, and Calgary Flames. Braid also spent 7 years with the Athletes Training Center as director of skating development. Hanin Amir came to the United States with her family after fleeing Iraq through Syria when she was 11. In 2015, at the age of 14, Amir published a poem called To the Sun, A Refugee's Journey Through the Eyes of a Young Girl. It's the story of a 15-year-old girl who recalls what life was like before her family was forced to leave their homeland for the U.S. Amir describes the fear and uncertainty that her own family endured before coming to the U.S., and she spoke with youth-produced Generation Justice about this and her experience thus far in the States.
I'm Jordan Unverzat. I'm a youth producer at Generation Justice, and I'm here today with Hanin Amir. Can you please tell me more about yourself?
I'm Hanin, and I am 14 years old, and I've been living in the U.S. for about 70 years now, and I really, really love it. I've met some amazing people here, and I love to write, I love to read. I kind of like art in general and language art. And in Arabic, I would say, اسمي حنين وأني عمري 14 سنة وأني أحب أقرأ كل شيء هواية وأحب أكتب وأحب أرسم وصلي بأمريكا 7 سنين.
Tell me more about your writing. Was this the first poem you've written?
Actually, no. I've been writing for as long as I can remember, learning how to write and read. And this was actually one of my latest poems that I've written. But I've been writing, I think I kept a diary when we first got here. I used to write in Arabic, except now my writing has transitioned into English just because I'm more open to it, I guess. It's on TV, radio, music, books are in English, so I started thinking in English and writing in English more. And I just really enjoy to write.
Awesome. I used to write poems when I was your age as well, and I continue to journal, and it's a good way to kind of challenge ideas or find out things about yourself or just kind of release feelings.
Yeah. I use it a lot just to get to know myself. Sometimes when ideas don't make sense to me, I write them down. That way I can just look at it from a different perspective, if that makes any sense.
Totally. I agree 100%. What was it like getting such amazing feedback for your poem?
I can't even explain it. It just kind of felt like, wow, people listened and they liked it. And that kind of gave me a feeling of empowerment that I can get to people, that I can use my voice for more than just inspiration. If one, to make people feel like they're understood, their situations are not, they're not alone in what's going on with them. And that's kind of what I want to give them the feeling of, that I'm a person here and I'm a refugee and I've had the same experiences they've had. Also to inspire people to start writing because it's a way to connect with others. So I've met a lot of people and had different experiences just through my poem and getting it published. It's been really amazing.
Yeah, your voice is incredibly powerful and you have such a beautiful way of observing and describing things. I really liked the line in your poem, "People here dress their dogs." I think it's funny, but it also really speaks to the ridiculousness of American consumerism. How have you started to form your identity in America?
Well, I think a lot of that has to do with my friends, and I've been trying to make myself based on things that they teach me and they show me, but then also mixing it with my original culture from Iraq. It's an interesting mix. Like, sometimes people, they won't notice that I'm not from here, and then I'll do something and they're like, wait, what are you doing? And I would just explain that this is how we do it in Iraq, or like different foods that I'll eat they've never even heard of. So I've been kind of building myself based on things that I like, that I see Americans do, and what I've already have. It's an interesting mixture.
What challenges have you faced and continue to face as you adjust to American life?
American life in general, sometimes the way they say things or the way they joke, the way they act with each other. Even now with my friends, sometimes they'll talk a certain way or they say something and I take it too seriously, or I'd look at it a completely different way from what they meant. Also fitting in, just because not trying to mold myself like them, but being able to understand them and them being able to understand me. It's been a challenge just to kind of try and understand what they mean sometimes. Or there are lots of things that I don't know about the American culture. Like a bunch of people have seen Indiana Jones and I've never even seen that. Or they'll be talking about like Star Wars. I don't know what that is, and they're always surprised to that. Sometimes I'm new to things and I still am. That's been the hardest so far, and it still is.
I haven't seen Star Wars either and I still get made fun of for it, so don't worry.
That makes me feel better.
What do you miss most about Baghdad?
I would say everything, I guess, except all the heat and being really restricted, I guess. But I still feel like I had an amazing childhood. I remember going a lot to my grandparents' house, and the house is there. That's my favorite memory, remembering what the houses used to be like and different smells. I know that's weird, but sometimes I'll smell something here and it's really familiar, and that kind of takes me back to like my grandparents' house or our old house and our backyard. And at my grandparents' house, I used to stay a lot with my aunt, who was like my best friend, second to mom, of course. I remember she had her bed right next to a window. And the window was really big and she had plants around it. And I used to sit on the bed and just look out the window and kind of make up stories about the people that I see. I remember going around the house and just looking and exploring at things. And I used to think it was really, really big. And I just wish I could see everything one more time now to see if everything really was the way I thought it was before.
Do you plan on going back?
I don't think so. Right now, not in these conditions. Even if I go, I don't think I'll be able to see the house because I don't know if it's the same anymore. So I would hope to, but I don't think it's possible.
Yeah. Is there anything you want Americans who may have never traveled to the Middle East to know about Iraq?
Everything is different. And people here, yeah, they wear clothes, and then people in Iraq wear clothes too. It's just completely different, different styles, different music, and a different way of just interacting with each other. And I'll say that most Iraqis that I've met have really bad tempers, so be careful with what you say and what you mean. But then we'll also joke around, and we're really social people. We like to have family around all the time, and we're just really close in that sense. So yeah, and it's an amazing country, or at least I know it used to be. It blew my mind sometimes when I would see an old picture of what Iraq looks like, just because I don't remember anything about the outside except the houses that I used to live in. And sometimes the way people dressed, even, it seems strange to me now just because I don't remember it as much. So yeah, just keep in mind that everything is different.
Do you still write?
Yeah, I don't keep a diary, but I'll write poems, or sometimes if I see a movie, it gives me an idea. And then I'll be listening to music, and that kind of gives me an idea too. So I'll build something up. It's like that. Sometimes I'll write about something that frustrates me. Or if I read a book and it really interests me, I'll take the way that I understand it and make a thought out of that and write it down. Or like I said before, I'll write down an idea to understand it better. And sometimes I'll just write down like parts of my life so that I can look back and see what it was before, because I'm always interested in what my mom's life used to be like, and I want to make sure that I know that I have a way to remember what my life used to be like maybe 20 years from now.
When I was mad at my parents, I'd write down like parenting tips to my future self. Don't do this, don't do that. What sort of role does music play in your life? I know you play the viola.
Music not only inspires me, but I love to make music just because it gives me a completely different feeling from writing or listening to music. And I just feel like everything is better with music. It just gives me a whole new spirit. Sometimes even taking a test and listening to music, I can do that. Going bowling, listening to music, it just kind of pumps me up. I love it so much. And playing the viola has just made me more experienced with that. I got to know it from a different angle. And usually I'll tell my mom at concerts that you get to listen to it from the outside, but I'm inside the music. I am making the music. And it's completely different when you're making it versus when you're listening to it. I think it's amazing to be able to do that.
Is there anything else you want to add?
You'd be surprised at things that you're able to accomplish if you try. And I know you've probably heard that a lot, but I never thought to try and write a book and get it published, but I have thought about writing. And so if you're really into something, then try to make something out of that. Especially if you're good, then there's always a chance that you'll be able to make it more than it is. If you like writing music, then start composing and then show somebody, and then it can be something amazing. So yeah, have courage.
I just think you're such an amazing human being and so talented, and I'm happy that you're continuing to write, and I hope that you continue to share what you write. I look forward to reading future poems, and I feel really privileged to be able to speak with you today and hear you recite your own poem. So thank you.
Well, thank you so much. Just hearing that makes me feel amazing too.
And now we turn to an adult's immigrant experience and her take on motherhood. Sandy Baroy for KALW has more.
Every immigrant has a coming to America memory. As a grad student in Illinois, I remember car dealerships lit up brightly in the middle of the night and not a soul in sight. Naomi Munawira came to America when she was 12. It was the mid-80s and Duran Duran.
The music of the 80s and that sort of androgynous, big-haired, eyelinered men in tight pants. I mean, it was amazing. Duran Duran was the first concert I ever went to, and it was like, holy cow, this is sexy. I don't know what I'm feeling, you know.
In her new book, What Lies Between Us, her narrator also loves her Duran Duran. But this is not just a book about teenaged immigrants discovering rock. It's a different kind of immigrant story.
They hate me because I am the worst thing possible. I am the bad mother.
Not Naomi, but her character, the narrator of the novel.
This is Sandeep Roy in San Francisco.
The classic immigrant story has a well-established trajectory. Flee famine, war, child marriage, pursue the American dream. The parents sacrifice so the children can have a better future. The children fall in love with the wrong people and break hearts.
I'm bored with a normal immigrant story. I think we need to complicate it. I think we need to really, like, test it.
In What Lies Between Us, a mother and daughter arrive in America, fleeing a dark and terrible night in Sri Lanka. Both are damaged in ways they do not realize.
It's a book about childhood trauma and the consequences of that upon our adult lives. And this is something that, like, is completely untalked about, especially in a South Asian context. People are not talking about trauma.
The book opens with the narrator in a prison cell, accused of a crime that she says is the worst a woman can be accused of. Naomi reads,
"The walls of my cell are painted an industrial white. They must think the color is soothing. Where I come from, it connotes absence, death, and loneliness. People write to me. Mothers mostly, they spew venom. That's not surprising. I've done the unthinkable. I have parted the veil and crossed into that other unseen country. They hate me because I am the worst thing possible. I am the bad mother."
I won't give away what the mother has done, but Naomi says it's not that unusual.
And then I started doing a bunch of research about women in prison, women that have committed violent crimes, and I found that the specific thing that my character has confessed to is actually not as uncommon as you would expect.
Because this is a book that begins in Sri Lanka, because Naomi was born in Sri Lanka, though she now lives in Auckland, and because the book is about childhood trauma, most of us will immediately assume that that trauma must stem from the brutal civil war that raged in that country for almost three decades. But that's where Naomi surprises again.
It's not about the obvious. It's not about the big glaring thing that we dealt with in Sri Lanka. Her trauma has nothing to do with the war.
It's actually a story about motherhood, about a mother in Sri Lanka and a mother in San Francisco. Naomi reads on.
"But here's the secret. In America, there are no good mothers. They simply don't exist. Always, there are 1,000 ways to fail at this singularly important job. There are failures of the body and failures of the heart. The woman who is unable to breastfeed is a failure. The woman who cries for an epidural is a failure."
Sri Lankan society, she says, in contrast, has a little more support for mothers.
You know, you get pregnant, you go to your mother's house, you get taken care of, you get cooked and pampered, and sort of your body is taken care of, and that continues after the child is born.
Here,
for most American women, you sort of, you get pregnant, you have your baby, now you have to lose the baby weight, you better go back to work immediately.
What Lies Between Us is not attacking mothers.
I also wanted to think about how hard it is to be a mother.
Or not to be one. As we just found out in Britain, even in 2016, it defines a woman. Two women vied to be Prime Minister of Britain. And the debate was not about Brexit, but whether motherhood made one woman a better candidate than the other. Naomi is not surprised.
I think that motherhood is still considered by most people to be that mark of what makes a woman.
She has chosen not to have children. She says her extended family will think she's not quite mature. Or they could just blame the corrupting influence of Duran Duran.
I love them. I was going to marry Simon Le Bon, and my best friend was going to marry John Taylor, and that was going to be our life. It was fantastic.
This is Sandeep Roy in San Francisco.
That's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. The show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. And follow us on Twitter at 51% Radio. This week's show is number 1415.